Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
We are the planets of the solar system. Different sizes for everyone. The music never ends. We are such good friends, and we all orbit the sun.
Here comes the sun, rapping first on this track. From the beginning, I'm the center of the solar system. Planets be spinning around me. So hot, I'm roasting, you see. Now I pass a mic to the planet closest to me.
Mercury, the smallest planet, small as Earth's moon.
Yo.
I get super hot and cold, and it's been very slow.
I'm Venus, I got mountains and volcanoes and spray. I'm the same size as Earth, but spin the opposite way.
Yeah, I'm Earth, I'm the home to every boy and girl.
Such a beautiful, beautiful world.
Oh, hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is March 16th. Thank you for joining me. Coming up on the show, my guest is Cynthia Day, a former public school teacher. All this is going to unfold in the show, but just a quick preview. A former public school teacher who left teaching for many reasons, but one of those reasons is she wanted to homeschool her own children. And after 15 years of doing that, she shifted her attention into creating an alternative school that encompassed all of the best aspects of the home education experience. Cynthia is the founder of the Days of Wonder School, and I invited her on the show as part of my continuing effort to showcase successful and inspiring alternative education models, along with what I think are some of the most desirable attributes of voluntary learning communities. So, like I said, Cynthia taught in public school. She didn't find it to be a very satisfying experience. We're going to compare notes on that. But a majority of our discussion is focused around the lessons Cynthia took from her home education successes and how she applies them to the Days of Wonder learning environment. I know there's many parents in the School Sucks audience who are currently unable to home educate for a variety of reasons, but many of these people, and these are people that I spoke to them during School Sucks Across America, they definitely see learner-centered schools as desirable alternatives. So when I have the opportunity to showcase one that I think is innovative and inspirational, I would certainly like to be able to take advantage of that. So if you're a parent examining your home education options, today's show will lay out what I really think are some key attributes to look for, or if possible, eventually to create in your own community. But I think this is also useful for people who are already doing home education. And even if you're a parent or a student just looking to survive the public school process, today's show will be helpful to you as well. So there we go. Everybody's happy. One more quick thing before we get started today. I meant to do this in the last show. I want to express some gratitude to all of you. I feel really, really fortunate that I have a career that allows me to interact with some really amazing people. And I've been really lucky. I mean, it's not entirely luck. I have like good social skills, but I have been very lucky that I've been able to turn many of the people that I've met along the way at one engagement or another into very good friends. And last weekend, I had just such an awesome time meeting a group of School Sucks listeners. I don't know if I want to put them in the box of being the School Sucks community in Philly, but I wanted to thank these guys for coming out and seeing me and showing me around the city. And we just had such an awesome time. Phil Serdum, Philip Figueredo, Brian Foglia, Ben Dasher, and Robert Kruger. I definitely look forward to getting back there. Philly is such an awesome place. We spent a good portion of our day and evening looking for Toynbee tiles. Do you know what Toynbee tiles are? This could be your next adventure. I guess I would start the story. The story in a nutshell. And if you want to learn more, you can go to toynbeeidea.com, or there's actually a documentary that's still probably on Netflix. It's called Resurrect Dead. But in the 1980s, all of these very bizarre, cryptic tiles started appearing throughout the Northeast United States. I think they go as far west as like well into Ohio, maybe even beyond Ohio, maybe as far as Chicago, maybe further, as far north as Boston. And they've even discovered a couple of them for some reason in South America. The tiles have a variety of messages on them, but the most common message, and these are like handmade tiles, like cut and assembled tiles that are then laid into the pavement of the street. In such a way that even though this was done in the 1980s, hundreds of these tiles are still on the streets in the northeastern United States today. The most common message says, Toynbee idea from Kubrick's 2001. So that's Arnold Toynbee, the historian. You might remember him from like the Rhodes Roundtable stories that we've dealt with in the past. From Kubrick's 2001, that's 2001, A Space Odyssey, the official movie of School Sucks project. So sorry, again, it says, Toynbee idea from Kubrick's 2001, resurrect dead on planet Jupiter. Like, whoa. And for decades, nobody knew what these tiles meant, where they came from, and this sort of urban myth and mystery developed around this until a documentary was made about it in 2011. So you might live in a city where these tiles exist, and it was really cool to be there with all of these guys from Philly, because Philly is the epicenter. The person who created these tiles, they were based in Philly. So there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them there in a variety of forms. And more than one of the guys I was with said, you know, I walk here all the time. I never noticed this before. So that was like a highlight. But we had lots of great conversation, lots of laughs, and I'm just really appreciative that I have the opportunity to do stuff like that. Because community is important. And hey, I actually have an inspiring story about that coming up on the show today. So let's get right to it. Huge thanks to Cynthia Day for coming on the show, and to Amy Hardy, a Days of Wonder school parent, who connected me to Cynthia. I really appreciate that, Amy. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and take care. Cynthia Day, welcome to School Sucks Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I am very excited to have this conversation. You are the founder of and a teacher at the Days of Wonder School in Batavia, Ohio. And right. A listener to my show named Amy sent me an email recommending you as a guest. And she said you're doing amazing things at Days of Wonder School. She said kids cry because of snow days. Kids skip lunch because they want to study. This is a quote from that email. Her vision is changing and saving lives. Kids play in the woods or outside for an hour and a half each day. They work in multi-grade classrooms. She does it all for a tuition of only $250 a month. So that's an excerpt of Amy's email. And I said, yes, because we are always looking for models of alternative education. The fact that you're able to bring kids in from like preschool age to high school age for less than what people pay for daycare is pretty amazing. So I want to talk about how the school works, but also what happens at the school as far as like pedagogy and routine is concerned. I wanted to start, though, with your background. You were a public school teacher, right?
Yes. Actually, I had a small stint in private school. And then I worked in public school, actually an inner city school. I was very interested in trying to help inner city kids. So I was lucky to get a job. I think I worked there 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I transferred into homeschooling.
Oh, homeschooling your own children?
Yes, homeschooling my own children.
Why did you decide to leave public school?
Well, for one reason was I had just had my second child, and that gets harder to work full time. But I think I would have stayed there forever had I felt support as a teacher from the other staff members. I guess back then I was still naive about a lot of things, and I assumed that everybody that became a teacher loved children and they wanted what was best for them, and they were going to work as hard as they possibly could to reach each and every child. And that certainly was how I felt when I got that job. But I very, within a couple of months, started feeling resentment from the other teachers. And I, looking back on it now, I really believe that I was bullied there, so much so that large groups of teachers wouldn't talk to me. And thank goodness there was one teacher that took me under her wing. And she just said to me, you know, once you're tenured, these teachers don't feel like they have to put forth as much as maybe newer teachers. And so they're not interested in learning new ideas. They just want to keep doing the same things they're doing all the time. And it just became to a point where I just, even with one person's support, I just couldn't continue in an atmosphere where kids were yelled at or ignored or berated in front of the whole class, things that I never dreamed I would see in a school. And so it just got to be so much that I couldn't stay there anymore.
Sure. Did you ever get any feedback, constructive or unconstructive, that would have given you some kind of clue as to why you were being shunned by other teachers? You're working too hard. You're too passionate. Mm-hmm. You're making everyone else look bad. Was there ever any discussion like that?
Oh, yes. I went to the principal and he was very good about listening. But he said, you know, they've been there a long time. They kind of have their own turf. They really don't. Just like you were saying, they just really don't want anybody that's over-enthusiastic or doing too good of a job. That might have been the case, but it really didn't provide me with how to handle it.
Absolutely.
I certainly wasn't going to lower my standards, and I know myself well enough to know that I wasn't bragging or insisting on other teachers doing anything their way. In fact, because I'd never taught in an inner city school, I was looking to them for advice. Some of them had been there 10, 15 years, but they just were not interested. And it was just so disappointing for me because I had a whole different idea of what I thought it was going to be like.
It really says a lot about the environment as well of public school, especially a kind of distressed inner city school. And I never worked in the inner city, but I definitely worked with that population for a number of years in a boarding school. And, you know, it's a really high burnout job. And just like it doesn't serve the students, it really doesn't serve the teachers. I mean, you're entering a mold similarly to how students are entering a mold. And, you know, the other side of that mold is probably a lot of what you are encountering as far as like work ethic or attitude or interaction with the students. I think it's often a consequence of the environment. Maybe you were starting to realize that just in a few years of being there.
Yes, and I do want to respond and make sure that listeners know that I'm not berating teachers at all.
Right.
Teachers have a terrible job, especially right now. And I do understand now about different ways that school districts decide to run schools. And I believe even back then and now, most of those are run from the top down, which means that the administrators and the school board tell the teachers what to do, what's expected, and they get no opportunity to add their input to any of that. And that is kind of how it was there. But now it's even worse with the standardized testing, for example.
Sure.
So teachers are told, you know, this is what you need to cover. This is how you're going to be evaluated. It's a terrible spot to put a teacher in. Now, imagine if it was the opposite, which is the way my school is. Mine operates from the ground up. So I tell my teachers, let's decide on a theme for the year. And then it's up to you how you want to integrate that in your classroom. As long as we reach these particular goals, not too many of them. And they then spend the summer choosing how they want to implement this theme, how they want to teach, what they want to cover. And they feel totally invested in what they're doing.
Absolutely.
And so they're going to cover all of their goals because they said they would. And so I just think even back then when I was in that school, if teachers felt like they had more ownership of the program, I think we would have had a better result.
Yeah, that's really well said. It's interesting. I was in graduate school the same time I first got my own classroom. So this was like 2002 to 2004. I was in my early to mid-20s. And I was getting a master's in education, and I was in these classes with all these people who are already a few years older than me, already teaching in the public schools, and they already hated their jobs because they were coming to terms with the fact that they were just stuck in this machinery that they couldn't change, that took all of their freedom and decision-making away from them from the very same reasons that you're talking about, the standardized test. This was like sort of at the height of No Child Left Behind. And on the other side, professionally, the first year I was a teacher, I'd taken the job at a very difficult environment in the school. It was like a separate campus for kids who had a really unique and difficult set of behavioral challenges. And I took the job to work my way up in this private school. And the first year, I just tried to do everything right, basically doing what I thought a teacher should do, you know, writing lesson plans, making kids sit in desks, going subject by subject with clear breaks between the subjects. And it was one of the most painful and frustrating frustrating and disastrous years of my entire professional career. The next year, all I did was I said, we're scrapping all of that. This environment cannot work along these traditional school type expectations. So I just turned it into a life skills curriculum. We created a, it was all centered around creating a school newspaper. So the kids were all employed in that. They got to engage in kind of like a game of life, like life skills, you know, get a job, get an apartment, even though we weren't really doing those things. But those 2 years, just the night and day difference between doing what I thought I was supposed to do as a teacher and doing what you're talking about doing with your teachers, like taking ownership over the teaching experience, taking ownership over the classroom in a certain respect, really speaks to the power of intrinsic motivation, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And what's interesting is I do not require a teaching license or degree to teach here. And these are the kinds of people that were never exposed to education classes like you and I had. And without that, there are many of them are able to just look at the kids and feel from them what their interest is and where to go with that. And so I sometimes regret that I had the education that I have, but that's okay. In my homeschool years, though, I homeschooled for 15 years, I saw the same thing. I saw parents with no education background at all doing absolutely amazing things with their children. And I would take a notebook and say, tell me how you're doing this. Tell me how you're making these things happen. And I wrote down everything that they told me. And I decided that sounds like if I could have that in one setting where we're all just introducing a topic and then listening to the kids and saying, this is the direction that they want to go. Let's just go here. But again, you have to have the freedom from set curriculums and set goals and so forth.
Absolutely. And I think when you don't go through all of that training, education feels more like a cooperative endeavor between young people and adults. My perspective is kind of interesting because I went through the certification process, like I completed all the courses for certification, and then I was doing this job that I was describing at the time. So I wasn't sure when I was going to transition into the public school. So I just put like the certification exam off and my career just kind of went in a different direction. So I don't know. I think I could see enough of, you know, not being like a fully trained teacher. I dropped out of the master's program that I was in and really, you know, early in my career through that experience that I was describing, just started trying to find my own path to feeling successful as an educator, but also creating an environment where the people that I was pretty much responsible for every day could also feel successful. And that was less top down. The top down approach didn't work in that environment. And when I changed it, like I said before, the results and just the enjoyment of the job went through the roof.
That's exactly right. When you were talking and you were saying, once you find yourself not restrained by certain limitations, I also feel that education becomes natural. It just becomes a natural thing that you do. And it also becomes fun. And that's the main thing. We get kids in here all the time. They don't even want to get out of the car and come into our school because they're so afraid.
Right.
They've had such a bad experience wherever they are. And we eventually get them in, and usually within a day or two, they're ready to sign up. And the thing that has to happen first is you have to have the kids accepted for who they are. And then they just can't believe that learning can be fun. And I just feel that we've lost that. What can be fun if we're expecting teachers to simply prepare kids for a test, for example? There's no fun in that. And there's also no application of that to real life learning.
Yeah, it's completely disconnected. And what was really frustrating, I started telling students this at the end of my tutoring career, is that a lot of these tests you're taking, they're not even for you. They're not even to test your aptitude or your accumulation of knowledge. They're assessing the school. You know, a lot of those, I think they're every other year or maybe every 3 years in some schools, those types of standardized tests. So yeah, that's an extra frustration for teachers and students and parents. But I wanted to talk about your transition from teaching to being a homeschooling mom. And were there any like key lessons you took away from the time you spent in public school that you wanted to apply to home education with your own children?
So things that I learned in public school that I wanted to still do with my own kids?
Or just the opposite, things that you wanted to avoid, just takeaways from that teaching experience that you didn't want to bring home, or things that were missing, I guess, from the public school experience that you really wanted to incorporate into a home education environment?
Well, I wanted to do exactly what I was doing in public school because I didn't know any better. I didn't know any better. And I got my three kids together and I said, what do you want to learn about? And oddly enough, they all said, we want to learn about chocolate. And I'm thinking, well, okay, chocolate. So we went to this school store because, of course, I couldn't begin to study chocolate without a lesson plan book.
Right.
And I actually found one with lesson plans and all of that. The first lesson was learning the vocabulary about chocolate. So I wrote the words down and we're looking them up in the dictionary. And my son, who was 7 at the time, said, when are we going to learn about chocolate? You know, I just want to make chocolate. And I said, no, we can't do that. First, we have to learn the vocabulary and then we have to study the maps to know where it came from and all of that. That's the way I was taught to do it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that it wasn't successful simply because I had inner city schools or whatever at the time. I started going to homeschool activities because a week into it, my kids are saying they weren't happy at all homeschooling. I remember we went to our very first thing was a history club And this lady, she had them building pyramids and a sarcophagus and making a book about all the different pharaohs and all of that. And I took her aside and I said, how do you do that? And she said, I don't know. I just asked the kids, what do you want to know? And they said, we want to know how pyramids are built. And so she just dove into that. And I'm thinking, what a great idea. Dive into whatever you want to do.
Well, I think that, you know, there is something to be said for, you said you were teaching your children vocabulary about chocolate. And I think there is something to be said for going through a kind of initial process of identification, like knowing what the components of a subject are, and then kind of integrating those components and then turning that integration into action. So, you know, you identify what the parts of something are, how those parts work together. And I think that that prepares you for that third step of taking action. But when people are intrinsically motivated, all of that can happen very, very quickly.
Exactly. I noticed that as we got into the study of Egyptians, they started asking questions about what time of history is this? Where exactly is Egypt? What does this word mean? And that's when I realized you got to hook kids from the start on where they are. And then once you have them hooked, you can integrate all kinds of things into your lessons and they will automatically get it. As a matter of fact, they will remember it more because they're integrating it into what they already know and you're getting to them when their interest is so high.
Right. Absolutely. So from there, you spent about 15 years home educating your own children. And then when they had grown into adulthood, you wanted to open a school that incorporated all of the best aspects, the best experiences that you had in homeschooling. And that is Days of Wonder, right?
Yes.
So what were some of those aspects?
Probably the very first thing was that I didn't think children anymore need to go to school 5 days a week. We have access to information that I never had when I was growing up. If I wanted to learn something, my mother got us in the car and we drove 30 minutes to the library. But now kids have access to information all the time. So the position I came up with is that teachers will spark the learning and then the kids can spend 2 days a week, which happened to be Wednesday, Friday. I give them math, reading, and something else to do, but they can spend that day breaking it up and focusing on what they love. If they want to go further with something, they can, and they do great. As a matter of fact, by giving them that wide open space, I find that they go often beyond where I might have taken them had I had them 5 days a week. So that was the very first thing.
Right. And there's nothing holding them back like in a traditional school. Right.
No. Even when we teach math, we teach a basic concept, and the kids get a binder full of materials and worksheets they can do, and they're to work at least an hour. For some kids, that might be 4 pages. For other kids, it might be 10 or even 15, but I never give them an ending to how far they can go. And sometimes the kids may be in fourth grade, and I'm thinking, oh, they could probably handle 3 or 4 pages. They push themselves farther because they're into it, and nobody's giving them an endpoint. And right. So they're just motivated, which leads me to the next part, which is when I was in homeschooling, we taught many ages at the same time.
Right.
So that's the way my school is. I teach grades 4, 5, and 6 combined. And those fourth graders, when they see what the sixth graders can do, we have a lot of different competitions and things that they want to do. Like, what if I did more pages than a sixth grader? Like, go for it, you know, and they'll try to do it. So I think learning from people of all different ages is a really good thing. And then probably the third one that comes out of that is the fact that all of the subjects, as well as we can, are integrated into one subject. So we choose a theme for the year. And last year we did outer space. So if we're studying space, we can pull all of the subjects together as best as we can so that it's not a bunch of isolated subjects or lessons that you give to the kids every day. And that helps to pull everything together, and it helps the kids better remember and understand what you taught them because they can relate it to what they're doing every single day.
Absolutely. So those are three of the cornerstones we just covered there. And I want to make mm-hmm. them explicit because, you know, there's people in my audience who are either, you know, pursuing their own home education paths, but there's probably mm-hmm. a lot of other people who are, you know, trying to accumulate a list of good attributes of an alternative school environment. So we talked about what I think is one of the most important aspects of Days of Wonder, that students take possession of their own learning.
Mm-hmm.
This also goes on in a non-age segregated environment, which even mm-hmm. in that terrible year of teaching that I was telling you about, the 2002-2003 school year, I remember in all of the frustrations, one of the best things about that campus that I ran was it was age integrated. I had students who were as young as 13, and I think the oldest student I had was 19. And just the natural kind of mentoring relationships that developed in that setting, even, you know, kids in other contexts didn't like each other. They didn't get along. But in the mm-hmm. classroom, they would be able to work together if there was an opportunity for a young kid to learn from an older kid that he looked up to,
mm-hmm.
or for an older kid to feel like he had some responsibility. I don't want to necessarily say authority, but like the sense that somebody was looking up to him or looking to him
mm-hmm.
for knowledge. That worked really, really well. And this idea, the third attribute, the integrated curriculum, allowing kids to understand the connections between things across disciplines is really, really valuable as well. What's your theme this year?
Our theme this year is the wonderful world of writing and illustrating. So what we're doing is we're reading a lot of the Newbery books. Newbery Medal is a medal that's given once a year to an exceptional children's work of writing. And then they also give the Caldecott Award, which is an award for the best illustrating of a children's book. So we're having our own Newbery and Caldecott contest. The kids are writing a different story, put it in book form every month.
Mm-hmm.
And then in April, every person is going to have a table with all of their books on it. But in the meantime, I've put together a Newbery committee and a Caldecott committee of different people I know. And so we're going to actually give medals out in April when we have our big event. So kids can understand the whole process of coming up with an idea and writing a book, publishing, what that's all about, what it's like to be an artist and to try different genres and so forth. And, you know, for literature, we can study different authors. For science, we're studying trees and how you get paper.
Sure, yeah.
So we would love for you to come, by the way, if you would like to do that.
How far are you from Pittsburgh?
About 6 hours.
Okay, well, that's better than 15 hours where I usually am in New Hampshire. So yeah, I will actually be in Pittsburgh, I think, in April or May. So I definitely would plan a visit out there. It's definitely something we can talk about. I would love to see it. So a couple other of the aspects that I wanted to talk about at Days of Wonder, the continuity of instruction, except for high school. Teachers will have the same students year after year so they can actually see the growing process take place.
And when I was in public for that period of time I was talking about, when I was leaving, the principal had an exit interview with me. And he said, if you could come back under perfect conditions, what would those be? And one of the first things I told him was, could I please just have the same kids for a couple years in a row? And he said, really? You know, you were struggling with, let's say, Joey all year long. You would want him another year? And I would say, I told him, I said, you know what? Let me tell you something. You're always going to have children that are challenging, but I could start the year already knowing the children, already knowing their parents, already knowing their strengths and weaknesses. And he said, wow, I didn't think about that. Well, I wouldn't have it any other way, especially if I'm lucky enough to have a child for 3 years, since I teach three different grades. I know that we can dive right into learning from day one, rather than feeling like it takes you several months to get to know the child's situation and how they learn and so on and so forth. So it's really something that I got a glimpse of all of those years ago. Mm-hmm. But then when you're home educating, you're teaching your children and other people's children sometimes too. And when you see them year after year after year, you can really feel a sense of satisfaction with what you're doing, because you remember what it was 2, 3, 4 years ago that they were struggling with. And then you look at them now and say, wow, look how far they came.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I was training to be a teacher, I felt like a lot of it was really like lofty, idealistic. And then at the end, it was like, okay, everybody, good luck never being able to apply any of this into, you know, in the environment you're going into.
Right.
And I remember being told, I was in 2001, 2002, in one of these classes, a teacher said, and I'm sure it's an inspirational quote from somebody else, but she said, you know, the best teachers don't see themselves as teaching subjects, they see themselves as teaching mm-hmm. students. And obviously, yeah. That's the way it is in any home education environment, but mm-hmm. it is not really something that can take place in a school, unfortunately.
Right.
In fact, I was on a tour across the country meeting a lot of home educating families and visiting a few alternative schools. I met with a bunch of people from an alternative school in Kansas, and the woman who ran that place called Sparks Academy, I think she had, you know, a very similar kind of condition. She wanted to work with the same students, and mm-hmm. that's just not possible in school. Now, how does that, is it like all through elementary school and what would be middle school years, and then it just ends in high school because the subjects need to be broken out differently?
Right. My initial goal was to also have high school run that way, but it didn't work out for various reasons. But it's true. Once they're in ninth grade, they do take individual subjects, biology, algebra, that kind of thing. But I will tell you that the high school students are still integrated with themselves. We still have 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th graders that are all taking the same classes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just the day is just broken up into individual classes, even though I was hoping for something else. But especially if they're trying to get into college or a vocational program, they have to have credits and they have to have so many hours and all of that. So we are not able to do it after grade 8.
I gotcha. So I wanted to return to children taking possession of their own learning. And something that's related to that is they're able to set a lot of their own educational goals. This is something that I've been thinking a lot about lately, how to better connect like visions for certain areas of life, whether they're educational or professional or, you know, health and fitness related, to sort of medium term, like 3 to 5 year goals, to 1 year goals, to monthly goals, all the way down to individual projects, really all the way down to individual actions. Uh-huh. And I think that I had absolutely no training for this, either as a student in high school, as a student in college. Through a lot of my professional career, I was great at writing IEPs and setting, you know, bland, uninspiring goals for other people, but not really practicing it for myself and not really setting compelling goals. I mean, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the IEP process. So-and-so yeah. will increase proficiency in this content area number 5327.1 by 75% by the end of this school year, right? I mean, that's not a super exciting goal. But when you talk about kids being able to engage in the process of setting their own educational goals as part of, you know, having ownership over their own learning, what does that look like at Days of Wonder?
Well, I would say the first thing is that I make it clear from the first day that how far they get with their learning has a lot to do with their choices. Mm-hmm. That I was not going to be one that was going to say, now we're going to this subject, now we're doing that, then you're going to do this kind of thing. So what I would often say to them from the beginning, okay, let's write down, besides the basic things that I'm asking them to do at their Learn at Home days, what are your goals for that? What do you want to research? How far do you want to go in math? And so those are like daily goals that they work on. If we have a big project that we're doing, we'll take out the calendar, which I think is really important at as early age as you can. Take out a calendar, show them where we are and say, and we're going to have our project finished by this day. Tell me how you're going to get that finished. For example, what are you going to work on each week? And it takes them a while, but eventually they look and say, I've got 6 weeks, but I really wanted to make let's say I want to make a replica of a bridge or something that's going with their, whatever it is that they're working on. And they eventually be able to see, oh, I have to get it this done here and this done here and this done there. And finally, I would say, if you ask kids, once you put them in an accepting environment, if you ask them what their goals are, you would be amazed at what they'll tell you.
So absolutely.
My goal is for them to read 25 books a year, which is not happening in most schools right now because they have so many required things they have to read. Mm-hmm. But they're supposed to read 5 Newberries. I said 5 Newberry books is what I'm requiring. Does anybody else feel like they would read more than that? And of course they're going, yeah, I want to do that. I want to do that. And
right.
So again, we'll sit down and talk about it. And you know, how many would you have to read per month or per week? And then eventually they just get used to, let's say I read that one of their assignments is to do such and such. They'll say, well, can I do more? Could I draw my answers instead of writing them out? I'm just amazed at what ideas they come up with, because they also know that I will say yes to almost anything that they ask, could they do? If they're taking an initiative, I almost always say yes.
Excellent. So through this process, they're able to also create their own feedback, right? If they're setting goals that are measurable, they don't need external validation or response for what they're doing, which is great, which is intrinsic motivation. But there also must be some instructor feedback as well. I know that you don't have grades for most students until they reach high school so they can get transcripts and a diploma. But because grades aren't a feedback mechanism for most students, what does feedback, or I don't love the term positive reinforcement, but positive feedback, what does that look like from instructors in the school?
Okay. Well, when you said we don't have grades, you're right. And when kids come from public school and they turn something in, they almost always want to know what grade they got on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I took the child's work and sat down with him or her, I will say to them, how do you think you did on this paper? Or you look like you're not happy with this part of what you did. And so we constantly let the child give feedback on how they thought they did or what they might want to do better. And you'll find again that once they can get out of that mold of getting a grade, which is the teacher telling them how they quote unquote, how they did on that, that they have an investment in it too, and it becomes more of them evaluating their work. And you're right, they can't do that totally on their own. Kids are kids. They would rather not do some work if they don't have to. That's why you're correct about the adults also have a responsibility to set the goals high. And I will interject if a student says, well, I just think I did great on that. And I'll look and I'll say, I'm just wondering about these words right here. They're at the beginning of a sentence. Is there something we could do to improve that? Oh, you're right. It starts with a capital letter. But
right.
if I just accept what they say, they're not going to improve in certain areas. You absolutely need an adult there that knows different milestones on what they should be doing at different grades and different ages.
So it's the encouragement of conscious living, right? And honest feedback, I think, is really, really important. Something that's come up on my show a bunch is like the idea of the 11th place ribbon, which is really just, if it's like you get an 11th place ribbon in bowling, it tells you two things. It says, number one, you suck at bowling. Number two, we don't think you can handle knowing that. And kids
right.
know that, So not getting honest feedback from adults in an educational environment is a real problem, because I think it's an extra sting involved in that. So being able to have that kind of environment where there's enough ownership over one's own education, it's not just about pleasing authorities or pleasing adults or getting good grades. So when failure happens, which is obviously, it's a cliche to even say this, but failure can be a great lesson. It's not a catastrophe, right?
Correct.
Because it's not just all about pleasing somebody else.
Right. And that was a really good point that you made. We now think today that erroneously that self-esteem comes from praising. And also intervening so that kids never feel jealousy, disappointment, anger, things like that. But in what I've read and what I've experienced, self-esteem, good self-esteem, comes from doing. When they do score a goal, they know, like you're saying, hey, they might be pretty good at this. If they do this particular project and it feels good to them because of what they did, that build self-esteem. Giving everybody a trophy for, like you're saying, doesn't work. And as a good example of that is when we have our Newbery Medal celebration, I've already had several moms come to me and say, the whole school is competing for a set of medals. That means there's going to be some kids that aren't going to get any. There's going to be some classes that don't get any. And I said, let's talk about the real world. Do you know that there are 15,000 children's books printed per year, and they choose between 1 and 5 to get medals? That's the real world.
Mm-hmm.
That's the
Absolutely.
Real world. And they're competing against beginning writers, experienced writers, in-between writers. That's exactly what our kids are going to do. It's not about if they're disappointed, then that's what they work through. But it's also about celebrating people that do win. It's also about learning from people that do win.
Absolutely. And I think self-esteem, that idea, like self-esteem is a really action-oriented pursuit. And we actually did a series on my show called The 6 Pillars of Self-Esteem. It's based on a book by the psychologist Nathaniel Brandon. And he broke it down as, the first pillar, and these are actions. These are things that you can do every day, is living consciously, right? Getting honest feedback from what's going on around you, but also assessing your surroundings honestly. The second aspect of that is self-acceptance, which seems like, from what you're describing, is what self-esteem is all about today. No, you're great. Everything is fine. Just accept yourself. Accept yourself how you are. It's good to engage in a practice of self-acceptance, but that is not the totality of self-esteem.
Uh-huh.
Once you kind of accept yourself, you've honestly accepted yourself, and also based on an honest assessment of yourself, you can take responsibility. You can take action to change, which is his fourth pillar, or third and fourth pillar. Three, take responsibility. Four, self-assertiveness. And, you know, once you're engaging in these first four steps in a repetitive way, you know, the fifth pillar is living purposefully. It's easier to find that purpose when you're going through that initial four-step process. And then the sixth step is living with integrity, the culmination of the previous five. So I think that is a much better lesson than an inclusive 11th place ribbon program for kids.
And you know what? Kids are intuitive.
Yes.
If you look at them and you say to them, what do you really think about this? Or what do you think about the decision that you made? They'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
They you can't praise them falsely. They know that it's not true.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So we covered just about every educational aspect of the school that I wanted to talk about, except one. You have a page on your website that talks about why Days of Wonder is unique. One of the ones that I just wanted to spend a little bit of time with was memorization. The standard approach in school today is that students no longer need to memorize things. I would be an opponent of rote memorization for the sake of rote memorization, but I think there is something really, really valuable about engaging with the mind and understanding how it works. I had to kind of confront this in my own life a couple of years ago where I used this cloud-based program. It's called Evernote. It's just an organization system, and it's kept track of everything that I've done, every project, every learning pursuit since 2013. And in 2016, I was doing like a theme year, like every month would be a different theme. In the middle of that process, I was cleaning out my Evernote system and updating it. And I just, you know, was going through old projects and I said, wow, look at all the stuff that I've learned that I have absolutely no memory of. You know, so I wanted to learn a little bit about memory and how I could optimize the memorization process and, you know, just basically become a better operator of my own mind. So I'd like to hear why you felt that this was something that was worth including on the Why We're Different page of the website, and also how that looks in the learning environment.
Well, I thought of that because I noticed that kids can't recall, they can't bring forth information that they've learned.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started thinking, you know, if we just finished studying the Vietnam War, I would like them to memorize a summary of what happened in the war. It can be their own words, but I want them to walk away and feel like they know when it started, why it started. What was the strategy of the war? Who won? Those kinds of things.
Mm.
And so I will ask them to memorize, maybe not word for word, but an understanding of that, so that when we go to the next war, say the Korean War, I can easily compare what we're studying now with the Vietnam War that we just finished. And so often the kids cannot do that. In schools, you take a test on the dates or the years or whatever that might be. But I want them to walk away with an understanding of the entire event of the war. And then that way, they come away with understanding all of that. And then it's so easy for them to compare that to what we're learning now. So that's kind of how it came about. I just didn't see students that were able to recall anything that they had learned.
So memorization here is not necessarily, like if we just want to stick with history and wars, it's not necessarily about getting lost in the weeds and remembering dates and names and battles
exactly.
for a test. It's about remembering the lessons or the sort of essences of a historical event so that it can be translated to learning about another historical event. Is that fair?
That's exactly right.
As far as memorization is concerned, how much help do you think you get from having an educational environment that encourages intrinsic motivation and self-direction? And I ask because, the keys to memory that I realized from doing that series and reading all that material that I read for that series in 2016, being able to maintain a high level of attention and knowing how to distribute attention properly were two like really, really key attributes. And I think if a person has that intrinsic motivation, that maintenance of a high level of attention is obviously mm-hmm. so much easier to do versus engaging with things that you don't care about. And another right. thing that you mentioned about your school is this idea of self-referencing, right? Understanding the relationship that something has to you, or even referencing in general, the relationship that this thing has to other things that you're learning about, or mm-hmm. even getting ready to do a presentation on something or to share. This was another part of the school, is students share, if they go beyond what mm-hmm. what you're offering, they can come back and share it. So they're actually right. becoming teachers in their own way. That's a form of self-referencing too. And self-referencing is really, really useful for encoding things into the long-term memory in a meaningful and useful way. So it sounds like there's a lot of things going on in the background at Days of Wonder right. that actually help with the memorization process versus just the sort of drill and kill model that we get in school.
Wow, you did great. Thank you.
No problem.
I hadn't put it all together like that, but it's well said.
Right. Well, I remember the sort of rote rehearsal of, you know, middle school and high school. I remember it being particularly torturous in middle school. It was almost like learning the Pledge of Allegiance, where there was no mental effort that went into it. Like, I remember saying the Pledge of Allegiance and not even knowing what all the words were. I was just right. kind of, all I had to do was kind of stand there with my hand on my heart in a group of 25 kids saying something mm-hmm. that kind of sounded like what everybody else was saying, and right. it was good enough. And that really relates to the process of memorization that we did in school. There was no mental effort. Right. There was no tie into anything right. personal or previous information or related information. Right. And it was just easy to dump at the end of the week. We'd barf it right. back up onto a quiz, and then it would be forgotten.
Right, exactly. Would I have a few minutes to talk about what you were talking about, our low tuition rate?
Oh, please,
and
yeah.
how we do that?
That was the last thing that I wanted to get to, because I think that, you know, a stumbling block that a lot of people encounter when they're looking for alternative education or private education even is cost. So when Amy told me about what your monthly tuition is, I was, first of all, amazed, but I really wanted to learn how you do that.
Well, we're always scrambling for money, so I'll let you know that from the beginning. But when I opened Days of Wonder, the first year we had it in the basement of my home, I really had no idea who my target kids were going to be. I just knew that I wanted to get back to teaching, and I wanted to try these ideas that I had. But it only took a year or two when I realized there's a whole population of kids that we are not serving. And those are the kids, for whatever reason, are not able to be successful in public school, but their parents cannot afford private school. And once you really think about that, because I know I hadn't, I realized I don't need to go to the inner city to look for kids who really need a different approach, who really need this opportunity, but their parents can't afford any other option. It's either stick with public, where my child is miserable, mm-hmm. or go to private school, which is thousands and thousands of dollars, or I homeschool, and then there's lots of reasons why some parents cannot homeschool. I have plenty of families whose both parents work, so
right.
it's not possible for them to do that. So that became my mission. That became, I want to make the, what can we do? What can we do to cut costs? And one of the things that ways we do it is that with a low tuition, we require every family to put in 40 volunteer hours here at the
oh,
school.
Wow.
And
yeah.
they are completely willing to do this because they know that it's either here or it's usually going back to public school. And so we found an old building, which we basically renovated on our own, but we try to take care of as much as we can on our own. And if we have a problem with the toilets, for example, that are clogged, instead of getting a plumber, we'll just put a note out. Does anybody know anything about the problems that we're having. And we don't hire anybody unless we absolutely have to. We just operate on a shoestring. And having said that, I just wanted to put a word out for the teachers that I have, because they put in so much time and energy, and there's no way that they make what their counterparts would make if they were, you know, teaching in a different school with benefits and all those kinds of things. But what I found out is that they know the mission. They usually have kids that attend here. And so we're extremely lucky to have teachers that are willing to work for that amount of money.
It's just like the conclusion of that for me is, when you don't have endless amounts of, you know, taxpayer money
right.
to throw at things in a way where it's completely disconnected from the original earners of that money,
uh-huh.
who might be the same people who are relying on the schools to educate their children. When you don't have that mechanism set up, the result is community. The result
yeah.
is the building of an intentional community where everyone is invested in the success of the students and the success of the school
right.
and the happiness of the teachers.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That is awesome.
Well, thank you. I will say that we've grown so much, we need to move to a new building. And that is one thing that nobody's been able to provide for us, if we're not able to find something that we can do with our limited budget. So I did want to put in there that we're now realizing that, as good as that philosophy is, you do come to certain points in your mission where you do need help. So that's kind of where we are right now. But up until this time, we've been able to do it some way, somehow.
How many students are at the school?
We have 141.
Oh, wow.
So we started 17 kids in my basement, and we've just increased every year to the point where even finding a place to talk to you is difficult, because we have, you know, we've used up basically every inch of the building that we have. And we want to go for, there's just so much need out there. We want to just keep on growing. And I've even been asked before if I would open up different locations of my school, which I'm not sure how that would work yet, but I'm really honored that somebody would think that way.
Mm.
But I just think it's a testament to what kids need today. We're just not meeting their needs like we should be.
And you have plans for expansion, it sounds like you're saying, even just in a singular location, if you can't move to multiple locations. Like, do you have an idea of how many students you'd like to have in one location, or what you think is workable?
We usually just go with the limits that we're given. So,
sure.
You know, I think we're reaching the maximum of what the building will hold. But I personally do not see a point where we would run out of kids to come here, if you know what I mean. There's just a need. So, right, we're either looking at an additional building near where we are now, so maybe we could move the high school there so we can expand the other grades, or we're looking into moving the entire place to a bigger building.
Okay, so how can people learn more about the school?
Our website is the best place to go, daysofwonder.org. And we also have a Facebook page as well that people can look at, and also tells you some of the events that we're hosting and things like that.
That's awesome. So I'm always really happy anytime that I can share a story with my audience about, you know, a place where people can come together so that you have that community. And the building, like the physical location, is really important to people, but there's still a way for students to learn as individuals. And it sounds like that is
Absolutely.
Exactly what is happening at Days of Wonder. And that's just an amazing story. I'm really glad
Thank
that
you.
We got to tell it on the show.
Oh, I'm so glad for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you very much.